Comedian Chris Gethard has a history of putting his own spin on stand-up comedy. He once staged a tournament where two comedians would have 5 minutes to be funnier than the other one. The winner advanced, and the loser was shot with a paintball gun. Chris used to think his ideas were too weird, but not anymore. He's written a memoir in which he encourages us to embrace failure. It's called Lose Well. Chris says that the best advice he ever got was from his therapist.
Basically, when I first came to her, it was 2007. I'd been, you know, banging my head against the wall trying to be a comedian for 7 years at that point. And when I was that age, that felt like forever. I mean, I was 26, 27 years old. 7 years was a big chunk of my life, and I wasn't getting anywhere. And I was hitting that stage that many of us do where I started to watch my friends go everywhere. And it was that line I had to walk between, you know, joy for my friends, but also a lot of panic for me. And that panic was really taking over my life, hence why I sought out a therapist. And she made it really clear, you got to give yourself no other option at some point. You either go all in or you don't, but you don't just sit on the fence forever. Meaning, for me, she said, cut off every source of income you have that's not the type of thing you would want to do, whether that's acting or performing or writing comedy. Mm-hmm. And I explained to her that it was a very bad idea because I paid my rent through all my freelance gigs. And she said, well, you can pay your rent forever and sit here panicking, or you can go all in. And she made something very clear, which has proven true to me in my life, which was, if you take this big swing and it doesn't work out, you're going to be a lot happier than you are sitting in the middle ground.
Mm-hmm. You ask yourself the following question early on in your book, Lose Well. So if I recognize the success in my professional life these days, why would I promote failure instead? So let me ask you that very question. Why are you promoting failure instead of success?
I think, especially as Americans, we are raised to have this idea of you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you go make things happen. And I think there's some real nobility to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some real good advice in that. But I also think that it makes this issue very binary, very black and white, very much like this idea of you win or you lose and that's that.
Yeah.
And I think that when you commit to the idea that you might fail, and in fact that when you do fail that that's okay, you start to find a middle ground. And the middle ground has so many more layers to it than that. It's got such a broader spectrum of possibility than that. And what I have seen over and over again in my own life and in people around me who work in creative fields, non-creative fields, what I've seen over and over again is that when you embrace the idea that you might fail, you very often get to happiness quicker. Things like that I was becoming known for.
As you say in your book, you thought your weird ideas were a roadblock to a successful career, when in reality, they were your greatest asset because they were unique to you. So why did you not have more confidence in your ideas?
Well, it's not easy to be a weird person. It's not.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. I think a lot of us feel it. I think a lot of people probably just nodded their heads, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not easy to be the weird one. And I had to realize that. Like I was saying before, a lot of my friends, they were just out and out hilarious. They were better looking than I was. They were taller than I was. They had looks that lent themselves to being on TV more than I did. What do I got left in my comedy career? I'm a weird guy. I'm an admittedly strange guy. And, you know, I sat around apologizing for those ideas, feeling like they were dumb or silly in the hopes that maybe I could turn into something I wasn't and turn into one of those people who was going to meet with traditional success. And then when I realized that wasn't going to happen, I think at a certain point I said, you know what? I think I'm pretty proud to be the ugly duckling. I wish I didn't spend all those years apologizing for it. Maybe I wouldn't have been so stressed out.
Yeah. You have this great description about why you didn't have more confidence in your ideas that really ring true to me, and I think would ring true to our listeners. You said that it makes sense that your most unique ideas feel terrifying because they're creatively risky, and they also expose the inner workings of your brain. You have to learn to turn off the self-doubt about these ideas, which I think that's very true. That just really nails it right there. So how did you learn to turn off the self-doubt about these ideas? Just was it the way people reacted and people said, hey, that's a cool idea, Chris. Was it that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, even that didn't get through. I mean, these shows would sell out. These shows would be met with people being really enthusiastic, and I still felt so, I would cringe afterwards, and I think, well, what if someone from the industry saw that? Mm. I can't have that. It's okay if this guy's kid's drinking cans of beer in a basement. in New York like it, but I'm like, I got to clean up my act. So it took a long time. And I actually, as many things in my life happened, someone pulled me aside. The artistic director of the theater I worked at, he was a good friend of mine. Years before he had that job, he and I were friends. And he's the one who said to me, he goes, you gotta make a show that's just this stuff. This is what everybody loves from you. Why aren't you just embracing it? And he forced me to name it The Chris Gethard Show, which proved to be a huge, huge benefit to my career. The idea that I branded my name on this idea of this sort of like aggressive New York weirdness comedy. And it took me way too long. And I was pretty obtuse. And there were many times where I could have embraced who I was and I didn't. And one of my major goals in writing this book is the idea that maybe if I just lay all that out and kind of look at my past and provide it as any sort of information or blueprint for people coming up after me, maybe they'll spend less time apologizing for who they are. Maybe they'll waste less hours, less days, less years feeling self-conscious, and maybe they can kind of skip to the front of the line as far as doing it punk rock style and doing it themselves and creating their own avenues.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Chris Gethard Show, which you started doing in 2009. Do you have a favorite example of a weirdest idea that you did on the show?
I mean, well, that with that show, there's every episode was weirder than the last. It kind of became this community-driven attempt to top ourselves. It was, what was the weirdest moment? I mean, there was one time where a random studio audience member came on camera when we were still on public access and started beating me with a flog. That was not a great moment in my life. What else? I've had kickboxers beat me up. I've had dominatrixes beat me up. I've been doused in almost every substance. We once did a bit called The Human Crane, where my effort was to make myself the claw in a big human-sized version of the claw machine game from
Arcade.
Okay. Yeah. Almost got dropped on my head and broke my neck.
Oh, dear.
Did a lot of strange stuff on that show. Pretty proud of it.
No, no pressure at all. If you mess up, it's just perhaps the end of my career. So what do you want to show us? What's your weird body? What are we thinking here?
Well, you said show us the weirdest part of your body, but mine's actually a missing body part. I'm missing my two front teeth.
Okay, I'm wide awake. Alana Glay. Alana Glay, so happy. Naomi, how'd that go down?
Well, when I was 12, I had a diving board accident.
Ooh.
And I won't really go into it, but I damaged my four front teeth. 6 years later, they were dying, and then they got pulled last summer.
They got pulled last summer. I think you look great both ways, first of all.
I would never have known.
Never have known.
Never have known. And I'm also like, that's so dope. I would use that all the time.
Yeah,
I would go.
You say that one of the most frequent dream killers we often use is that no one will get it anyway. Why do you think we so often use this as an excuse to talk ourselves out of our pursuing it, our dreams? Just because it's easy? It's easier to give up than to press on?
Yeah, I mean, I think when things look difficult, it's very often tempting to find the pressure release that gets you out of it. Mm-hmm. And saying, oh, everybody will think it's weird anyway, is one that's always kind of sitting on the top of our tongue.
Yeah.
It's weird because I've written a self-help book, but it's all based on actual personal experience. And I'd like to think that I'm no sort of guru. And I think you can hear that in my voice. I'm just trying to lay out what happened for me. I think when you stop saying that idea of, you know, oh man, everybody will think my idea is so weird. And when you start realizing that that might be an asset, what happens is that the weirdos who like it, they really like it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They stick with you forever. You become their person.
Oh, sure.
You know,
yeah.
I'm not the most popular comedian in the world by a long shot. And very often when I get press, you look at the comment sections, people will be going, this guy's not very funny. But then you'll see the people who do like me and they'll go, oh, well, I would take a bullet for this guy's work. So back off. And I think there's something to be said for a smaller idea that feels very honest and true, that the people who connect with it so hard.
Right.
I think that is something that should be a point of pride.
You've had this mantra for the past 10 years that you say is, you describe it as goofy and a little embarrassing. It's a two-word phrase that you always say to yourself when you're writing, strategizing, or thinking big. What is it?
Oh, funny plus, of course. That's one of my favorite chapters. That's become a very informative thing to me. That's just the idea that you should, at the end of the day, seek to raise the bar, not just meet it. We often, when you start out at something, you're bad at it. Mm-hmm. So you want to just get good at it. So you look around at the people who are good at it, and you go, I want to be as good as they are. And I would say, no, try to be better than they are. And I'd argue the way to do that is add something to it.
So let's talk a bit about how this idea of Funny Plus has influenced some of your most popular work, starting with Career Suicide, your 2017 HBO special based on your off-Broadway show of the same name.
Right. Well, you know, Career Suicide dealt very much. I think it's a very funny show. I stand by the funny parts, but it also has a lot of stretches where I talk honestly about what it's like to be in therapy, to have depression, to be on medication, to have had suicidal thoughts. It gets very, very dark. So I'd like to think that the funny parts of that one are extremely funny, but it's funny plus uncomfortable, funny plus disturbing, funny plus sad, funny plus overly honest in some people's eyes. It's aiming to add some elements to the platform of humor that you don't normally attach to it. See what I can get away with. And yeah. I think that one hit a lot of people in the guts in a way I'm very proud of.
Yeah. How has Funny Plus influenced your podcast, Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People?
Well, in my podcast, the whole show is I just take a phone call and I talk to someone for an hour. They never tell me their name. I'm not allowed to hang up. It's as simple as that. And I thought it was going to be kind of an extension of my TV show where people would be prank calling me. I figured it'd be, you know, a lot of college kids and high school kids just messing with me. It instead became a thing where people would tell me their dark secrets. People tell me their stresses. And I realized it's funny. Plus, it's very empathetic. It's not the funniest project I do because I've learned that it's about the callers. It's not about me. And there's times where the callers are bringing up stuff that is not funny at all. And I have to sort of sit on my instincts as a comedian and let it be what it wants to be.
Yeah.
But, you know, on its best day where that balance is there, I think I'm a funny guy. I'm looking for some laughs. But also, it's very empathetic. It's very listening-based. It's funny, plus it has this layer of empathy.
Is there one particular episode of Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People that you're especially proud of?
There's one that came out recently, just a few months ago. It was someone who was a survivor of the mass shooting in Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
She had been attending that music festival when that very, very sad, twisted incident happened. And she told us for an hour, sort of beat by beat, what happened. Her husband had been a medic in the military, so he sort of pushed her behind some cover, and he took off to run into the fray to help victims, and she was so scared for her husband, and there's this kind of chaotic scramble to get out of there, and it's a pretty intense beat-by-beat breakdown of what that day was like for her, and it's hard to listen to. It's also pretty surprising at points. She, you know, talks about some of her reactions to it in a way that I didn't expect.
August 4th marked 58 days until the one-year anniversary. And 58 is kind of an important number because that's how many people were killed.
58.
So in honor of the 58 people, myself and a lot of the other warriors have started a journey doing 58 random acts of kindness in honor of each person that was killed.
Wow.
And, yeah. So, you know, I haven't smiled so much, you know, in the last year or so than when I'm doing my random acts of kindness.
But I'll tell you, the thing I'm most proud of with it is that it's just one person's experience. Mm. And it really is just her telling us what her experience was. There's a lot of things in this world now that by the time you or I or anyone listening hears about them, they have been placed through a politicized lens.
Yeah.
And I was very, very proud to be able to have someone tell that story in their own words, first person, and their reactions to it, first person, in a way that wasn't filtered through the opinions of a platform that had motives beyond just telling the story.
Yeah. Near the end of your book, you say that we should make it a lifelong goal to always be terrified. What do you mean?
I think that there's a lot of truth in that. That, I think, is one of the most basic pieces of advice I can give in this book that's undeniable, which is you start out at something. It feels really daunting. It feels impossible. And if you work hard enough and you put your head down and you're willing to run into enough walls, eventually you run through the wall. You start to realize, oh, it's possible because I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And then you go, now let me try to do it at a level that I'm proud of, and now let me keep going. And at a certain point, you'll realize, oh, this is not scary at all anymore. If you get to a point where you feel proficient at your dream, to the point where it no longer terrifies you every day, replace that terror in your life. For me, I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu, the martial art, which I promise you, if anybody could see me, I'm a visible wimp. And I say that with pride. I am to the naked eye. If you walked past me on the street, you'd go, that man is a wimp. And I go and I wrestle stronger, younger people 4 days a week. This morning I was wrestling a 22-year-old man who weighs 175 pounds. I'm 38. I weigh 145 and I'm tired. Like, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. But as I've become more proficient at comedy, I want to remember what that fire in the gut feels like to just be bad at something and frustrated by it and uncertain if it's ever going to work out. I think that those are feelings that can be unhealthy if we let them, but they can be very productive and very healthy if we utilize them.
Chris Gethard is a comedian, podcast host, and the author of Lose Well. You can find out more about Chris at WPR.org/beta.
When we think about hip-hop now, we think about it as, you know, like Chuck D said, the CNN of the street. You know, we think about it as music with a message. It absolutely opened up possibilities for hip-hop music.
Hip-hop artist Shad Cabango explains how Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five changed the course of music history with their 1982 hit, The Message. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey.